Hello, my name is Philip Mirton, and today we are going to have a conversation beyond science and religion.
Breaking new ground in thinking, exploring the outer limits of what we know about the world and ourselves, unhindered by common beliefs and perceptions. This is Conversations Beyond Science and Religion, taking on subjects from the Big Bang, the multiverse, and evolution to the supernatural and the new rising consciousness. This is where scientists, philosophers, New Agers, and spiritualists come together to discuss where this world may be heading. Now, here's your host, lawyer, philosopher, and the author of The Heaven at the End of Science, Philip Mirton.
Now, today's show is entitled, Is Religion More Natural Than Science? As I said in the past, the purpose of this show is to break through the common mental structures or lenses through which we see the world. And as we discuss in other shows, our modern mindset tends to put science and religion into different categories, different worlds, different buildings, different books on the shelves. One of the most famous originators of this two-world theory is the former and late Harvard biologist Stephen Jay Gould, who in his book Rock of Ages talked of science and religion as commanding different realms. Science, he said, gets the empirical, physical world, and religion the world of morals and values. And so in that structure, science and religion could live happily ever after, not intruding upon each other's realms. Another perspective on the same theme is the often repeated mantra that science deals with natural explanations while religion deals with the supernatural, or in other words, phenomena beyond the natural world and thus beyond the proof or concern of science. And yet a further perspective, again on the same thing, comes from a list of who I would call God deniers or religious questioners such as Richard Dawkins, Lawrence Krauss, or the late Christopher Hitchens, who point to religion as being some sort of childish preoccupation with myths. In his new book, The Magic of Reality, Richard Dawkins, for example, remarks that those who wrote the foundation religious texts, such as the Book of Genesis, must have known that they were writing fiction at the time they were writing these early inscriptions on the stone tablets or the parchment or however they did it. But if religion or spirituality is all a delusion or an illusion, it sure is a hard one to shake loose from. So I was reading in the recent issue of New Scientist, they had a special issue called The God Issue, The Surprising New Science of Religion, and I came across an article entitled Natural Religion, Unnatural Science by Robert McCauley. Now, at least the title of this article may suggest that things are perhaps upside down. How can religion be more natural than science? And so I'm very happy to have as a guest on today's show Dr. Robert McCauley, who is author of the article. Now, Dr. McCauley is an associated professor of philosophy, psychology, and religion, and anthropology at Emory University in Atlanta. He has a PhD from the University of Chicago, and he's also the director for the Center for Mind, Brain, and Culture. And his new book is entitled Why Religion is Natural and Science Unnatural. Now, welcome to the show, Dr. McCauley.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, so first of all, why do you say that religion is more natural than science?
Well, that cuts to the heart of it. the kind of naturalness that I'm talking about is naturalness having to do with human cognition. I'm interested in sort of how our minds work, and so I'm involved in the cognitive sciences, and that's why, in effect, I've got all those affiliations across a number of disciplines. The suggestion is that, and then this is not anything that's new with me. I mean, it's certainly been out there in the world of cognitive psychology and cognitive science now for at least 40 years, and that is that there's at least a broad distinction that can be drawn between sort of two forms of human cognition. One is we can call the intuitive forms, what I call the natural forms of cognition, that is to say, things that are fast, usually unreflective, not the sort of things that we articulate very well, deploy them with incredible efficiency, we still find it tough to talk about them. So, for example, our knowledge about someone's emotional state by looking at their facial expression or hearing their tone of voice or seeing their bodily comportment, we are pretty confident that we can read those things fairly accurately, and yet if we were to really try to articulate exactly what the cues are that we pick up on, we can say a few things about that, but it's not terribly easy. This is in contrast to, I suppose, what most people think is sort of all of our thinking, and that is our conscious thought, our conscious reflective thought, which is overwhelmingly in language. We, as it were, think in language an awful lot of the time, and it, by contrast, is slow. It's deliberate, it is, as I said, sort of the conception that most folks have about cognition, of all of cognition, but sort of the great accomplishment, really, of the cognitive sciences over the last 50 years is to help us to understand that there's sort of not just that upstairs, but there's a downstairs as well. That downstairs of intuition having to do with everything from, as I've said, reading emotions to recognizing faces to our ability to use natural language as fluently and as easily and efficiently as we do, yet again, without much ability to really articulate the grammatical principles that inform all the speech that we produce and the speech that we comprehend in a wide range of domains. So in short, how is religion natural? I'm suggesting that religion, popular religion, and I want to stress that is to say, reflective thought about religion of that second sort, the slow, deliberative sort, is certainly possible. It comes in a variety of forms. I suppose the best known is theology, but also sort of the projects I'm doing, which is to say I'm using slow, deliberate sort of cognitive scientific reflection to think about religion as well. So that's another form of sort of slow thinking about religion. But what I'm suggesting is that popular religion overwhelmingly relies on the first form, the first kind of thought, that is to say, the fast, intuitive stuff, and that religions around the world and throughout human history have engaged these systems that tend to fire fast and operate in a variety of very particular domains.
Yeah, one of the sort of threshold questions is that when we use different terms that suggest that they mean the same thing, but when we get into the professional language, it suggests that the term means something at a higher level or different. And for example, we've heard of the word innate, and we remember from, I think it was Descartes or one of those early philosophers who had this idea of innate ideas, something that in my mind was sort of integral to the mind itself and did not come from experience. And then you know, you've used the word intuition, and you've also used the word maturational. Pronounce that right.
Yeah. Maturationally natural cognition, that's right.
Right. Now, what is there a distinction between these three terms? And that would be innate, intuition, and maturationally natural.
Yeah, the probably. Well, first of all, they take on they address a number of different dimensions. But when I talked about those fast systems, those fast intuitive systems, in fact, that language is language that's, you know, in Daniel Kahneman's new best-selling book, Thinking Fast and Slow. But one of the things I'm arguing, and actually argue fairly extensively in the first section of the book, the first two chapters, is that amongst that fast intuitive thinking, there are actually two types. One type is, in effect, what I call practice naturalness. That is to say, amongst this natural intuitive thought, one source of it is just comes from practice, from lots of experience, from having extensive amounts of opportunities to characteristics. In effect, it's a sort of an expertise that humans have. And wherever in those domains that we have expertise, we tend to have, again, these kinds of fast intuitions. I don't mean by using the language of expertise to suggest anything, terribly esoteric. Take any major city in the world that has an extensive public transportation system. In those cities, tens of thousands of people have a lot of experience with those systems, and they know how to buy tickets. And they know that even whether or not tickets are something that are necessary, for example, as opposed to tokens or as opposed to electronic devices and so on. They know how to get through the turnstiles, the layout of the system, and that's not anything that they have to sort of sit around and ponder at great length because of their extensive experience. So I don't mean necessarily something by talking about an expertise effect, something that's, esoteric or anything like that. By contrast, and that's what I would call, sometimes we say that when we have a lot of experience in a domain, we say that, people know it, as it were, as second nature. And that's right, it's second nature, because the other sense of intuition that I want to point to is what I would call sort of first nature, and that's these maturationally natural systems. Maturationally natural systems are systems that may or may not be innate, whatever innate means. Frankly, I have formulated the notion of maturational naturalness precisely to avoid the long-standing battles that have raged about, whether or not various capacities of mind are innate or not. I guess most famously the battles have been about sort of our abilities to acquire and use language. When Noam Chomsky argued 50 years ago that we had some innate language acquisition device. Well, I don't know if we have an innate language acquisition device, but I think there's loads of evidence that language is a different sort of domain than, say, something like playing chess or mastering a public transportation system. The reason I say that is because these maturationally natural systems are ones that address very, very fundamental problems in human life and are critical to human survival. They typically develop and emerge without any instruction. We don't teach our kids to talk. We just talk around them, and they start to talk. But we do have to teach our kids to read, and we do have to teach our kids to write. Moreover, these systems are really up and running and in place in human minds before humans even realize that they are up and running. What I mean by that, for example, is that we remember when we have developed a practice naturalness in some domain. We remember when we started to learn to read or when we started to learn to ride a bicycle. But we don't remember when we started to learn language or when we started to walk. Those are maturationally natural capacities, and I should stress that they can be perceptual, they can be cognitive, they can be action capacities. One example of, action capacity would be, say, something like the fact that young children by about 3 or 4 years of age, or certainly by 4 years of age in most contexts and across all cultures, are quite aware of the fact that there can be contaminants in their environments. And they know about how, the principles for contamination and how to avoid contaminants and that they should avoid contaminants. And again, this is nothing that, anyone's taught them.
Just
to return to the basic question, again, are these systems innate? Well, there may be some kind of preparedness that is, in fact, even in the genome, but the concept of maturational naturalness enables us to capture this subset of intuitive systems without having to sort of fight that battle.
Yeah, and I think that the real issue here for me is whether you are saying that if something is maturationally natural, whether it's that way because it's simple, because it takes less effort, or whether there is something sort of inbred in the makeup of the brain or the mind. And that's so, and I know that you've addressed that topic, but and it comes up when you contrast the attitude towards religion with the hard practice of science.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd like to know your thoughts on whether you believe that this instinct here, this transparent intuition, is more because it's easy or because there is something beyond that, something that, you know, is part of being human, for example.
Well, you've asked a lot. Let me say a couple of things. First of all, as I'm sure you're well aware, I never use the word instinct, and I would be wary of using it. But I do understand that it's a kind of rough and ready concept for much of what my notion of maturational naturalness captures. Are the systems simple? Well, in one sense, yes, they are simple, but it doesn't mean that the problems they address are simple. They're simple in the sense that to the extent that these kinds of systems deal with, as I've said, sort of basic problems critical to human survival, they are systems that need to work very fast. So in recognizing agents, I mean, probably the most famous of these systems, and certainly the one that pertains most directly to religion, is theory of mind. Babies have to decide figure out very early on in life what kinds of things in their environment are agents and what subset of events in their environment constitute the actions of those agents. Because agents are both things in their environment to which they can appeal for aid, and they are also things in their environment that can pose dangers for them. There is now evidence in developmental psychology that four-month-olds have got already a clear ability to distinguish a number of features of agents in their environment from non-agents. Likewise, you know, I mean, is language simple? Well, no, language is not simple at all. Language, in fact, is so complex that it's not the case that linguists have ever even successfully constructed an entire grammar of even one natural language. Yeah. Language is an astonishingly complex system, and yet we've got five-year-olds who are, By the time that kids are five, typically they're fairly fluent speakers.
One of the things that's always that I think language is a great example of this. And one of the things that it's sort of humorous, but to think that children in China, you know, can understand Mandarin. I mean, it's when the logical, as an adult, if we try to learn Mandarin now, I don't think it's possible. I might have to go on about a 10-year sabbatical or something to do that.
Well, that's another feature of maturationally natural systems, and that is they typically are systems that have particular sort of constraints on the time in which they can be readily or easily acquired. I mean, some of them are definitely infiltrated by culture. There's no question about that. I mean, language is the obvious illustration of that. You're right. If you and I went to China right now and tried to sort of start learning Mandarin, it would be a tough row we would have to hoe that would take us a long time. But if we took my 1-year-old granddaughter to China and left her there, she'd be a very fluent speaker of Mandarin in just a few years.
Yeah.
And that suggests that there are sort of critical periods in development for some of these capacities, and that in those very rare and unfortunate situations, alas, in which a few, even in our time, we know about, where people have been isolated from having the kind of proper inputs to tune these maturationally natural systems, they remain forever impaired because of that.
Yeah.
So there are, for example, these occasional stories that arise. lies, including even on a few occasions here in the United States, where abusive parents have basically kept a child in isolation and away from normal language and normal conversation. And a very famous case in Los Angeles, probably 3 decades ago now. And even after, you know, the kid was found at about 12 or 13 years of age, she basically never acquired fluent spoken English.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, you know, going to religion now, and this is another different level of concept of beliefs. I mean, language is one thing, but now when you move to religion, and particularly, you know, as you point out in your book, you're talking about the retail variety. I like the use of the word retail, which I would also maybe call mainstream or orthodox. Whatever, but
or popular is
popular, and so this concept that an adherence to myth, to stories, to narratives, to pictures is a more natural movement of the mind than analyzing what the real purpose of the physical world is and how it came to be and how it evolved and all that. But it raises the question, is that natural inclination to religion, is it false? if it's natural, does it mean that it's true? And that's a question I had when I was reading your book. I wasn't sure whether you were saying it's so natural that we're never going to shake it, or whether you were saying it's so natural, we're never going to shake it, and so we're just going to have to deal with it, because even if it's not true. So what's your thought about whether, when you use the word natural, rationally natural, whether that means there's any truth to it, or whether it's just part of our minds and we just have to live with it?
Well, I'm certainly saying that in human populations, human populations will not shake these notions. That's correct, that they will persist. I'm not saying that every individual will be religious. I mean, that would be a patently false claim to make, and
right.
I wouldn't make it. But amongst populations of human beings, and in actually all human minds, the kinds of capacities that religions trade in are capacities that I think have gotten into human minds for very different reasons, having nothing to do with religion, but nonetheless are capacities that are there. And we don't shake this agent detection theory of mind capacity. We don't shake our knowledge about how to manage contaminants. Are they true? They no doubt have some elements of truth in them. They were true enough, as it were, to sort of get our ancestors to reproduce. That's for sure. And of course, the point is that doesn't always mean that you have to have truth. You just have to have sort of dispositions of mind that will get you out of the tough fixes and take care of all your sort of needs for survival.
It's like that old, yeah, go ahead. It's like that old saying, and maybe this is a little off point, but the saying that there's no atheist in the foxhole. I mean,
under conditions of there's actually good experimental evidence bearing on the notion of sort of putting our cognitive systems under stress. Now, foxholes, needless to say, are particular forms of stress, but actually you can do it in much simpler ways. Experimental psychologists have dozens and dozens of ways of, putting subjects under cognitive stress by having them try to do two tasks at once, for example, so-called multitasking in parallel. But when you put our minds under this kind of cognitive stress, the evidence suggests that what happens is however well-trained someone is, they're inclined to sort of head back toward the deliverances of these maturationally natural systems.
That's interesting. So, I mean, you obviously have read, or at least are familiar with, the works of Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett and these other folks.
Yeah, I've read some of his books, yes.
Yeah, that have, I mean, they're very, very good writers, very good thinkers. And of course, they're taking, and to be specific, because Richard Dawkins is so prominent and it has so many well-done books, I'm going to use him as an example. But he has so many books that talk about essentially that religion is what I would call a childish myth that you have to grow out of, and then there is the spin where he recounts all the terrible things that the strict observance of certain religions has caused in the world, the religious wars, the burning of symbols, the destruction of temples, etc., etc. So I take it you're saying, and you said this in your book. You said that the campaign against religion, based upon an admiration of science and scientific rationality, will not meet with much success. And why don't you elaborate upon that point? Because I think that's a very interesting sort of interpretation of where Dawkins and others are going. I'd like to have your sort of spin on that issue.
Well, sure. What I'm suggesting is that, indeed, as we've been discussing, if religion has a kind of cognitively natural appeal, and if indeed it will just inevitably arise in populations of human minds, you know, the probabilities of our sort of arguing everyone out of religion, it strikes me, are really, really quite small, vanishingly small. Part of that is, of course, a way of praising science, which is to say that science, as I'm sure you know, having read the book, that I'm arguing that science, by contrast, works on that second very slow system and requires all sorts of the acquisition of all sorts of knowledge and all sorts of skills that take not just years, but frankly decades to acquire. There are huge amounts of investment of resources and time and labor in acquiring a scientific education. And the fact of the matter is, science inevitably starts generating representations and theories that are quite contrary to the deliverances of these maturationally natural systems. I cite some research in the book, of course, that shows that even after comparatively speaking, a fairly advanced level of training in certain sciences, that with just a sort of positioning of problems in a very particular kind of way that aren't completely conventional and familiar, that performance of folks who even are very well trained can crash. Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman have become world famous for showing this in terms of our abilities to carry out inference in probabilistic domains, for example. I mean, the long and the short of it is we're pretty rotten probabilistic reasoners.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of work to keep control of those kinds of things.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
As with regard to Dawkins and you know, the Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris agenda, I mean, I'm certainly quite sympathetic with the notion that the kind of automatic cultural default that is accorded religion seems to me to be not at all a good thing. And so to that extent, I suppose I concur with some of their, you know, a lot of their views. But you don't argue people out of things that they never accepted because of argument in the first place.
Yeah.
I mean, this
that was
is,
well, yeah, that was well
in
said.
Short, these are, as I've suggested, sort of maturationally natural systems that are brought together and they're ones that are so easily cued, and they work, and crucially, and of course I've used this term a couple of times already, but crucially they're automatic, which is to say that although with a lot of training and expertise we can get some conscious control over them, it's really difficult to do that.
Yeah, before we move into a little different area, it's it's interesting that so many people, and I would say most scientists, it would include me, even though I'm not a scientist, but most people were raised in the popular religious worldview. This whole thing about going to church or the synagogue or whatever when you're young, and maybe taking catechism and taking the religious training and reading the stories, et cetera, et cetera. And then you gradually sort of evolve. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with the transformational consciousness movement or the Ken Wilbers of the world that talk about a sort of a evolution of consciousness or awareness, where you sort of move from believing that the religious symbols are outside of you to gradually realizing that the mind is part of the world, and sort of things are changing in your perspective. But from the scientific standpoint, there's so many people that use their logical thought processes, which is part of science, to criticize these natural beliefs and to rise above them, right? Mm-hmm. I mean it happens all the time, and so
sure.
And so how do you explain that? Do you think that even though you can't talk people out of these religious inclinations over time, there will be an evolution towards a more scientific, slow thought process?
Well, I certainly don't know about the particular figures that you mentioned and their particular views, but there is no question that, in the course of acquiring a formal education, which is something that has only been widespread in just a fraction of the world in the last couple centuries, important things happen intellectually, and people change their views about any number of points.
Yeah.
There's no question that science overwhelmingly comes up with verdicts about the world that are contrary to the deliverances of our maturationally natural systems. We find out that, we all say we're Copernicans, but the fact of the matter is very few of us even to this day sort of have any idea about how, for example, to see the sky as a Copernican.
Yes.
See the night sky in particular. I've got a little exercise in my book about that.
Yeah, I thought that was really good, by the way, because just for the listener, it's we know scientifically, at least we hope we know scientifically, that the sun is not going around the earth, right? And so
sure.
And so
sure.
But we talk about the sun rising, right?
Oh, yeah, sure.
I thought you gave a really good. It's sort of like we live in this poetry world, in this world of poetry, or this world of metaphor, pictures, and it's something that we don't give up on because either A, it feels good, it's a better way to live, or it's natural to our cognition. There's probably all sorts of other, or maybe we're just unaccepting of this rigorous mechanical worldview, but I can't see anybody, any scientist, I don't care how strict they are, to say, oh, the earth is now sinking. Look at instead of the sun rising. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me that would happen.
Well, specifically, the earth is turning.
Right, right.
We're also people who are, we are creatures who are very wedded to narratives, and we find stories naturally appealing, and in a way that when items, any number of events are woven together in a story, unified by the roles of agents and their actions, this makes something that comes out with a product that human minds just readily lap up. It's not at all difficulty for us. But going back just for a moment to the sort of the Dawkins Hitchens side of this, oddly enough, I mean, you know, they're fans of science, a champion of science as well, and I do think I am. But oddly enough, I sometimes fear that they underestimate the difficulty of learning science. Science is never going to be an easy sell because it grates so reliably against what we are inclined to think commonsensically, what we are inclined to think intuitively. It takes lots and lots of time and work and lots of resources. And so to sustain it, when you were asking about this question about the evolution of consciousness, I think that this is what's critical to that is sustaining a very elaborate social structure that supports science. You know, the notion of sort of individuals carrying out science only goes so far. The fact of the matter is it's a huge enterprise that is very expensive. And it's expensive because scientists have to get to environments that are sort of unusual environments in order to test the implications of their theories.
Yeah.
And sometimes getting to those environments takes a lot of time and effort and a lot of money.
Yeah, and you say that science is not going to be around for the long term. Is that right?
I'm sorry, I just didn't hear you.
I'm sorry. I believe you said at the end of your book that you believe that religion will outlive science.
Not exactly. What I did say is that as we've already discussed, I don't think that there's any probability at all that religion is going to go away. And by contrast, because of, in fact, the elaborate structure that it takes to sustain science and the tremendous difficulty it takes to acquire scientific knowledge and to do science, mastery of mathematics as well as the sciences themselves, and having the kinds of facilities to carry out science, that science is in fact fragile. Because that's a lot of stuff that has to all be in place. And if it isn't in place, science is always can be threatened with decline.
Yeah, and I think we're sort of at a point. You see, my own view on this is that I think that the scientific enterprise ultimately circles back to spirituality. Now, I'm not going to say it circles back to popular religion, and the reason I'm saying that is that things like the multiverse, which I think is the classic example of this, where is you know, the principle that one way to explain the unique fit between humans and the one universe we live in, the fine-tuning problem, is to imagine that there's a near infinite number of other universes out there.
Oh sure. No, I know about the position. Don't recall that I had mentioned it.
The problem there, I mean, it's funny because Steven Weinberg, who is a Nobel Prize winning physicist from the University of Texas, he has a passage in one of his papers where he says something like, science should not only deal with things that can be proven, but if there's a theory and we could show that other things exist because of this unseen reality, then that should be a scientific theory as well. So he's essentially trying to form support for the principle that even though a multiverse by definition can never be proven, we can point to other things such as the unique fine-tuning of our universe to prove that a multiverse exists. And it's things like that I believe show that science is not all that separated from some of these religious principles because they're relying upon the unseen, the unknowable, to explain the knowable. And so my own view, as I said, is that I think that the logical path of science ultimately circles back. But that's my own thinking on this. But I feel as if we ultimately need to have both. We need to have the slow and the fast thinking. We need to have the methodical thought processes, the logical empiricism, and and self-critical examination of theories. That's the hallmark of science. But then we have to recognize that this natural inclination we have to religion, to something beyond us, is actually true. See, I think it's true, and I think science ultimately proves that it's true. But again, I'm of the radical sort. But I like your thesis, because it is showing that we shouldn't just call people who believe in religious principles or myths as being essentially insane, like some of the other writers do. So,
well, they're certainly not insane, that's for sure.
Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
If you'd like, I can comment a bit about a few of the things that you said. I guess it was the last leap to truth is where I would not follow, I suppose. It doesn't seem to me that inference is either obvious or that it follows, and it's a question of, you know, needing lots of evidence. But I guess the other comment I would make is that it just strikes me that probably language of proof is not usually the appropriate language for science. Science is always tentative, and it's always theoretical, and it's always speculative. That's the engine of science, is that we come up with speculations, as you said, that go beyond sort of what the senses deliver to us. But it's the tracing out of the possible empirical implications of those speculations that lead us to assess them and to be able to assess them, I mean, empirically, broadly speaking, and experimentally in particular. Does the outer edges of science touch on metaphysics? I don't know. I don't think there's any question about that. The notion that at the sort of very highest levels of theorizing in actually probably any of the sciences, but certainly in physics, we're out at, where science and certainly the kinds of speculations, the speculative theories that scientists are offering bleed into what we might call more traditionally philosophical areas of interest and inquiry.
Yeah, and there's a lot of thinkers, and the last two shows I've had Amit Goswami on, who is a quantum physicist, who uses the findings of quantum theory to conclude that consciousness is at the base of reality as opposed to matter. And he's not the only one. There's plenty of people who come to those conclusions. And I think that at the end of the day, there is only one world, and so it would make sense if there is a theory that combined what you're talking about here, which is the cognitive element of religion, with the scientific enterprise. I mean, otherwise we are always going to be split into two separate worlds. We're always going to be saying, well, that's a nice thought you had about religion. That's part of your cognitive makeup. But then there's science over here that's dealing with all this nice, you know, with all the empirical stuff. And so do you think that there's ever going to be some kind of unity here, combining the theory of mind, this cognitive research you've done, with science, or do you think it's going to be separated forever?
You took a turn there at the end I wasn't quite expecting. I thought you were going to ask me about the connections to religion, but I certainly regard the project that I'm pursuing as one that is connected with cognitive science and is a part of cognitive science. I'm not an experimentalist myself; it's not my training. But I'm one of the I'm a naturalistically oriented philosopher who is very, very interested in the wide range of experimental findings that the sciences are generating that bear on these matters. So I'm certainly, in terms of my own project, I see it as finally part of a very, very large edifice, and, you know, sort of often one particular little area, little territory of that region that science is. I should say clearly that I regard my project as in effect a fairly high level theoretical project, but nonetheless a project in cognitive science. Sure.
Yeah. What I am really saying is that the current scientific model. I mean, one of the reasons why people like Stephen Hawking and Lawrence Krauss are so adverse to religion is that they don't think that it has any proof or any weight, any empirical evidence in the real world. But it seems to me that what you're saying is that if religion or the inclination towards religion is part of our mental makeup in some mm-hmm. way, then it is part of the world. Then it is part of the world. It's just, and we shouldn't be ruling it out just because we can't measure it.
I would certainly say that we shouldn't rule things out just because we can't measure them. I certainly agree with that claim, and that religious cognition and religious conduct are an important part of the human world, I think, is just uncontroversial. At one level, this is why the development and the emergence of the cognitive science of religion over the last couple of decades has been so exciting, because prior to that, there really wasn't a lot of research on religion and cognitive science, and yet religious cognition is everywhere. It's in every culture. It's occurring all the time, in effect, and it's a major element in, you know, human societies and human arrangements. And it's important that we bring our best tools to understand it. I mean, I don't think that the findings impugn religion or support religion. They are simply, it seems to me, mostly orthogonal. I don't know that a religious person needs to be shocked or upset or scandalized by the suggestion that religion basically works with human minds as they are, and in the same way that human minds and human beings are managing in all the other domains they face in life, they basically manage and think in the same ways in these religious contexts as well.
Have you ever evaluated this your theory of mind and religion in the context of Eastern religions?
Well, that's a good question. When you work in the cognitive science of religion, the practitioners who work in that area, all of us know that whenever you give a talk or perhaps even have an interview like this one right now, almost always, sooner or later, the question arises about Eastern religions and about Buddhism in particular. People will argue that, for example, Buddhism is not, in fact, really properly. That's not the right way to put it. But that it is not religious. It's not theistic. That is true about certain sort of esoteric strains of Buddhism, and those are, in fact, the ones that are best known and most popular in the West, but I have yet to know a single scholar of Buddhism, either the history of Buddhism or anthropologists who study Buddhism out there in the world, in Buddhist nations, that would maintain that Buddhism is not theistic. In fact, quite to the contrary, they would argue that it is as richly and theistic and filled with all sorts of agents with counterintuitive properties as any other religion in the world. Is it possible for their religions to in fact generate practices or schools of thought or various kinds of disciplines that could lead to things like, aiming for the dissolution of self and the absence of person in conceptions of either the universe or of deities. Sure, that's possible. Is that sort of straightforward popular religion? No, I don't think it is. I think it's, in fact, fairly esoteric sorts of things, that the kinds of things that even in the Western world and the great Western religious traditions are the kinds of things that theologians do.
Right. Yeah.
Typically, you know, places like seminaries or universities, and fairly isolated from, in fact, most of sort of the religion on the ground.
Yeah, I was actually making a little different point. And again, I tend to be a little on the radical side, although I'm a fan of both of spirituality and religion, and science, and philosophy. But what I was saying about mentioning the Eastern religions is that if you read certain writers in that area, such as Aurobindo, there's support for your theory, at least from looking at it from one angle. You have to be open-minded, but for example, Hinduism is based upon the self being part of Brahman, the individual person being part of a greater God mind. And then you have reincarnation, which most people in the scientific world would really raise their eyebrows up over, even though the Dalai Lama, one of the world's leading Buddhists, if not the world's leading Buddhists and leaders, and the winner of the Nobel Prize for Peace, he's the reincarnation of the 13th Buddha. The 13th Dalai Lama. And so when you look at that, I mean, to me, it's pretty sort of obvious that if you look at the mind as something evolving itself, then, and that if we're all part of one mind, then you could explain things like the language instinct and this inclination towards myth and a lot of these things you're talking about. And I'll be very honest with you, I don't expect you to buy into what I'm saying. All I'm saying is that, if we start looking at these different areas with an open mind and without our sort of rigid structure of thinking one thing's legitimate science and then something else is some esoteric religion, you start finding support for some of these scientific theories. And that's sort of where I'm at. I mean, I think that the Hinduism supports what you're saying, but I have a funny feeling that you wouldn't, that you don't think so, or something like that. But that's sort of where I'm going with this. I mean, and I'm not the only one who would say this. I mean, I think there's plenty of other Eastern religious folks that would say, "Oh, this sounds like the consciousness evolving." So, in any event, have you ever thought about this thing, or do you think it's just like off the wall speculation?
Well, as I said, I think that I don't know Eastern religions. I'm not a scholar of Eastern religions. I actually have seen the Dalai Lama. He is a faculty member at my university, in fact.
I didn't
he's
know that.
On the faculty at Emory University.
Wow.
And so he visits us at least once and usually twice a year, and, you know, is on campus for a few days at a time. And a number of the monks are in academic programs at Emory, and my center is, in fact, even sponsored a seminar co-taught by a member of the religion faculty, a member of the psychology department, and a member of one of the Tibetan Buddhist monks who is actually a faculty member in the religion department on contrast between sort of Buddhist and Western conceptions of Western scientific conceptions of mind. I'm not unfamiliar with it, but I want to stress I'm not a scholar of it either. I guess it strikes me the broader issue that lurks behind in trying to sort of at least feel out where I'm at on some of these matters. I'm willing to say this, and that is certainly that I do think that science is unsurpassed, but in its ability to generate knowledge. But I you know, as our first President Bush used to say about the American military establishment, it is second to none. And I think that that's true. But it doesn't follow from that that science is the only way humans acquire knowledge. In fact, needless to say, if my notion of maturationally natural capacities of human minds suggests that there are other grounds for knowledge that humans seem to possess, and that we, you know, feel some confidence about, if you recall, again, my comments about our ability to assess people's emotions in ways that are mostly inarticulate. That there are a wide range of experiences out there that humans have that are not easily brought into experimental settings to study and understand. I certainly think that's possible. But I should also stress, just as a kind of quick footnote about that, is that at least sociologists of religion have found that a majority of religious people actually don't report having such experiences. More than half of religious people in the United States, at least in one major survey that was done, don't report having had ever any particularly or peculiarly religious experience. And yet people are still actively involved in, you know, in religious institutions and religious practices and subscribe to religious beliefs. And my suggestion is that, again, that indicates that, you know, they haven't been argued into them, that actually the focus on religious experience is probably overdone because, in fact, most of this stuff is just stuff that is very naturally appealing from a cognitive standpoint.
Yeah, and I think, and just to be clear, where I come down on this is that I think that the scientific or critical evaluation should be applied both to the scientific theories and to religious beliefs, including Eastern religion. What I'm saying, and I'm not a big fan of just believing in the literal truth of the Bible, for example, because somebody taught that to you or whatever the orthodox viewpoint might be. But what I am saying is that if we use the same sort of self-critical, scientific, or Missouri, you know, show it to me, you know, or show me the proof approach to religion and to science, we might find that there is some common ground here that does have, and I, you know, the word science, we haven't got into it, and we don't have time really. That's a whole nother topic. What science really means, but if Hinduism is true or partly true, and the same thing for Buddhism, because they're similar in many ways with the self and the unity of consciousness, et cetera, then to me that helps explain some of these natural inclinations that you have so well discussed in your book, because it shows that there is a sort of a sharing of lessons over time, and evolution may not just be in the material world, but it may be in the mental world. And of course, what I just said is perhaps radical, but it would not be radical to Eastern folks. It might be radical to the Western philosophers. I'm sure it would be radical, but maybe they both folks need to take a step back and say, well, maybe we should rise above these criticisms and see if there is common ground. So we sort of have to end things now, and I want to thank you so much for your time. I want to recommend two things for the listener. Number one, if you want to know more, pick up the issue of New Scientist magazine. It's the God issue. There's a very quick summary of Dr. McCauley's book in there. It's the March 17th, 2012 issue. And then pick up a copy of his book, Why Religion is Natural and Science Unnatural. I think you'll find it very enlightening and very sort of stimulating, because the beauty of it is that it gives a different perspective on this debate we've seen in the press between the Richard Dawkins of the world and sort of the Jerry Falwells of the world. It's given a nice different perspective on how many of these things that we see as religion or the religious inclination could be part of our cognitive makeup. So once again, I'd like to thank you for your time, Doctor. It's been a great conversation with you. And once again, I've learned a lot. I hope you much success with your book and your future endeavors down there.
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's been good to chat.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Conversations Beyond Science and Religion with Philip Merriton. To find out more about Philip and his new book, The Heaven at the End of Science, visit heaven@theendofscience.com.